The Jaguars have big plans for the stadium, the sports complex, and the team as the NFL draft is set for this week. Good morning and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9, and thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live on the radio at 9, and make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, it's your chance to speak with Jaguars president Mark Lamping as we talk about the team, the stadium, the shipyards, Lot J, everything that's planned for the sports complex. So much to talk about. Even that new dog park, the first ever at an NFL stadium. What are your thoughts, questions, comments? Get on the line right now, 549-2937, as we talk with Mark Lamping of the Jaguars. Later in the show, our movable feast speaks with a local legend, Chef Matthew Madure. Don't miss that. Plus, the fight to preserve historic landmarks in the city's urban core, like the Florida Theater. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, lots of news coming out of the sports complex this spring. Last week, we learned that the Baltimore-based Cordish Companies has been hired to develop the downtown area around Everbank Field, and it'll soon be renamed TIAA Bank Field. New artist renderings released last week by the team and Shad Khan's company show an exciting complex of night spots, tall buildings on the waterfront, even a new dog park at the stadium, the first for the NFL. And in this envisioning, those overhead ramps coming off the Hart Bridge are torn down under this plan. Also, the NFL draft is this week, and the Jaguars have big plans there as well. Joining us now with his thoughts on the state of the franchise, plans for downtown, and more, we're pleased to welcome back on the program Jaguars President Mark Lamping. He's on the line. Hi, Mark. Good to talk to you.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
Doing well, thanks. And to our callers, whether it's your thoughts about the draft or the plans to develop the area around the stadium, the new uniforms, whatever's on your mind, it's your chance to connect with Jaguars President Mark Lamping right now. So get on the line. 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online and send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And we welcome your comments on our First Coast Connect Facebook page, too. We'll get to those in a few minutes. So much news coming out of the sports complex, Mark Lamping. Let's begin with the big announcement that you made at the State of the Franchise report last week. We finally got a look at some new artist renderings that lay out what you hope to do over around the ballpark, in especially Lot J. That is where you seem to be focusing your first development efforts. This is a really ambitious undertaking, could cost in the neighborhood of $2 billion, lots of moving parts to this. What do you see as the biggest challenges to executing this vision for development around the stadium?
Well, I think some of the biggest hurdles have already been cleared. First is to have a will to get it done. And, you know, that includes not only the Jaguars, but also the city of Jacksonville. The second hurdle is, you know, it's one thing for Shad Khan to be committed to seeing through a project like this. But you also need to have validation that it's a project that makes sense. And, you know, we were especially pleased to be able to announce that the Cordish company out of Baltimore will be joining us in this effort. And, you know, they have a tremendous amount of experience around the country in developing vibrant, sustainable urban neighborhoods that have a sports theme, whether they've done that in Kansas City or St. Louis, Arlington, Texas, Detroit, Louisville, many others. So we feel really good about the fact that, you know, they bring some validation to the project. And just like we did with the Daly's Place, the amphitheater, our focus is on Lot J because we think we can get started sooner on Lot J than on any of the other parcels. You know, that particular piece of property is covered under a lease between the Jaguars and the city of Jacksonville. And it's an easier project for us to get started. It's also a project that isn't dependent upon the elevated lanes coming down. So you can expect, and we've been saying this for a number of months that, you know, the first ground that will be broken will be on Lot J. We certainly don't expect that to happen during this football season, but we expect it to happen not that long after that, and then move on to other parcels, assuming that the elevated lanes come down, because that's such an important aspect in terms of being able to bring forward the most ambitious development on the banks of the St. John's River.
Let's take that into two parts. Two pieces moving there. With Lot J, there's environmental contamination. It used to be a manufacturing site. Petroleum underground. So you'll have to do some environmental remediation there. And then in order to bring down those ramps coming off the Hart Bridge, that will require some municipal cooperation, both at the city and the state level. How do you plan to address both of those issues, Mark?
Well, first, let's start with the environmental. There's environmental issues all along the banks of the St. John's River in this part of Jacksonville. So it's not something that's new. And Jacksonville's not the only community that has had to deal with environmental issues on the banks of their downtown waterways. You can remediate. You can work around environmental issues by virtue of the types of uses that you put in place, and you can also work around environmental issues by the types of structural programs that you implement beneath the surface. So, you know, we certainly understand the environmental challenges on Lot J. It's no different than what we've discussed in the past as it relates to the shipyards. And we're fully confident that we're going to be able to find solutions to work around those issues that were created many, many years ago. As far as the elevated lanes, I really want to clarify that that's probably more of a city initiative than it is a Jaguars initiative, and. Our involvement in that has been to provide a point of view that if the lanes come down, you have put the city in a position to, in all likelihood, deliver a more robust development on the banks of the St. John River. And quite honestly, you know, the city has done an exceptional job in advocating that position, so much so that there is already funding in place in the current Florida Department of Transportation budget for next year. I think it's a total of $12.5 million, and the city has made a commitment to match that in terms of trying to advance this project. So, you know, there's already $25 million that has been secured or will be secured, and there is also. An initiative in front of the Department of the Federal Department of Transportation to qualify for some matching funds. So that's the funding proposal. It's been in the works for probably at least a year, and we feel very confident based on our conversations with the city that this project will go forward. And as such, you know, we've been expending development dollars working on a design. Assuming that those lanes come down.
And before we go to calls for you, by the way, if you're just tuning in, we're on now with Jaguars President Mark Lamping. The number to join us, 549-2937. Before we get to all of the calls, of course, you're getting ready for the NFL draft. Can you share your thinking about the team strategy there?
Well, we have a lot of time to kill from the time that the draft starts until we pick, which is something new for us.
Yeah.
So we'll have a big event on Thursday. This will be the first time that we'll be really using Daly's Place as our draft central, along with the indoor practice field. So it should be a great evening. We'll have players in the new uniforms. We'll have live coverage of the draft. And we'll have a lot of other surprises for our Jaguars fans who choose to come down and spend a few hours with us. We pick later in the draft this year because of you know, the performance of the team last year. And, you know, we'll be picking later in the show unless the team moves up in the draft, in which case we would be picking earlier.
And how are fans reacting to the new uniforms, by the way, that you unveiled the other day?
Good. You know, I think that probably the best comments I heard is that, you know, people view those uniforms, and they do, they're simpler uniforms. They don't have as many design elements, and as such, they you know, they're probably a much more traditional look in terms of a football uniform. You know, not as contemporary as the last version of Jaguar uniforms. And I think all things being considered, if you can find the right uniform design, and if you have the patience and courage to stick with it, ultimately you're going to end up with a uniform that is, you know, receives much more universal acclaim, and people will recognize it. So the response has been good. It is clearly a traditional, simple design, and I think that was part of the design objectives, and not inconsistent with the key messages that people like Tom Coughlin have brought to the Jaguars upon his return.
All right, lots of calls for Jaguars president Mark Lamping, as the team is focused not only on the upcoming season for the players, but ambitious plans for a $2 billion development project in the sports complex. Did you see those artist renderings? What are your thoughts about that? The new uniforms for the team? Whatever your questions are, it's your chance to talk to Jags president Mark Lamping right now at 549-2937 right here on the show. Let's start with Rob on the South Side. Hi, Rob. Good morning. Go ahead, Rob. Turn your radio down and go ahead. All right, Rob, give us a call back. We'll try again in a few minutes. 549-2937. Tom in St. Augustine. Hey, Tom, thanks for holding. Good morning. Go ahead, Tom. What is going on today? I hope they can hear me. 549-2937. Mylan is in Ponte Vedra Beach. Mylan, are you there?
Yes. Hello. Hello, Melissa. Hello.
Go ahead.
Yes. So I just wanted to, in terms of the whole development, the Jacksonville downtown development, I just wanted to draw a comparison to the development of the London Docklands. If anyone's been there, and I know, you know, Jacksonville not necessarily the same as London, but you know, the London Docklands were, you know, 30 years ago, they were disused, run down. You know, nobody wanted to go there. You know, and now it's a thriving and a thriving business and entertainment district with the, you know, the London O2 Arena, you know, which draws, you know, concerts and shows, big name shows from all over the world, tennis, the round robin tennis tournament in November. You know, it's a thriving financial and business district, and you know, compared to 30 years ago. So I just wondered, you know, if anyone's kind of taken a, you know, look at that, how they did it, you know.
Sure. And Shad Khan, of course, has roots in London, so I'm sure he's aware of it. Mark Lamping, that's an interesting example to draw from overseas.
It is. You know, it is. And I'm very familiar with that area. And at its very core, it's very similar in terms of the principles that we're trying to follow here with the development around the sports complex. It's truly mixed use, and you know, we know that we have a concentration of large of event facilities already in place. We have Everbank Field, we've got Daly's Place, and the 50 or so concerts that you know, find their way to Daly's Place each and every year. We have the baseball grounds, and we have a lot of content during the summer at baseball grounds, and then we also have the Veterans Arena. What we'll be adding to that are places where people can work. Jobs are a really important component of this becoming a successful development. In fact, we believe that we should target to bring almost 2,000 jobs to this new neighborhood. That's critical because it brings people to the site each and every day. And then beyond that, housing, bringing people to the area not only to make the the office space that we may put in place, places for people that work there to live, but also to have a core number of people that are in and around the facility, these facilities each and every day, and then other things in the terms of meetings and conventions and things like that. In our original proposal that was accepted by the city, we had an exhibition hall, and in the renderings that we showed last week, we also showed a convention center and a large convention hotel. So, for a project like this to be successful, it's not easy. You have to have everything possibly going for you, and that means having people working there, having people living there, having people visiting there, and if we can do that exceptionally well, we think we can bring forward a true transformation to downtown Jacksonville, and hopefully put Jacksonville in a position where it can come closer to realizing its full potential.
Alex in Springfield. Hey, Alex, go ahead.
Hey, I'd just like to go ahead and say that I think it's fantastic that the downtown's being built up and making it a community where people can hopefully walk around and bike around and create parks for families to get out there and see nice green vegetation as well. I guess one of the biggest things I'm concerned about is traffic. And if the lanes come down, and that's just a byproduct of all the other traffic that's going through downtown, and it can get very congested at certain times of the day. So has there been any studies on what the traffic will do?
Yeah, good question.
When the lanes come down?
Yeah, that's a great question, Alex. Yeah, how will the traffic flow work, Mark?
Well, there have been traffic studies that have been done. And one of the real benefits from this is it actually makes it much more efficient for trucks and other large vehicles to work their way through the Talleyrand area. And it's one of the benefits of this new design that brings about the interest from the National Department of Transportation. Jacksonville is no different than many major communities across the country that have downtown waterways. When you go back a few generations, very seldom was there development on the banks of these waterways. It was commercial, and it was commercial because that's how materials were brought into the community and how finished materials were brought out of the community. It was via the waterways. That's no different than what we had here in Jacksonville. And then as part of that, the traffic infrastructure that was put in place was in many cases designed to avoid that riverfront commercial activity. So you saw cities across the country put in elevated lanes so traffic could go past the commercial bankside commercial areas. Some had tunnels that were put in place. And what you see, by and large, across the country, as these communities and the heavy industrial that was on the banks of these rivers has found their way else to other parts of the community, where they can take advantage of the transportation infrastructure related to rail and highways, and they've moved off a lot of these waterways. The communities come back and find that there's great development potential there. And what they have to deal with is they have this natural barrier that was put in place in the form of elevated lanes and depressed lanes that cut that off. So what communities do is, if you want to have a successful development, what you need is you need foot traffic, particularly if you're in an area that may be an area that for many years has not been developed, and perhaps there are security concerns. Getting cars to the street level, getting people to the street level, all of that makes people feel even more comfortable. And at times, may there be a little more traffic? Yes, of course, there will be. But the trade-off is that traffic is being created by virtue of an expanded community, of a community that has higher density as it relates to businesses and population, and the economic benefit of that. Many times outweighs what at times could be a little inconvenience as far as vehicular traffic.
Let me ask you as a follow-up. Let's say that your vision of pulling those ramps down, for whatever reason, isn't realized. It gets stuck in the bureaucracy or, you know, there could be obstacles to that. Is there a backup plan to work around that in case you cannot get those ramps down in a timely manner?
Well, yeah, it would be a much less ambitious and a much smaller development on the river. You know, those lanes create a lot of issues. By the way, those traffic lanes are used, I think, between 20 and 25% of their capacity. So it's not like those elevated lanes, and I drive on them frequently. Mm-hmm. It's not like they're ever crowded. So, you know, obviously, if it was a traffic way that was oversubscribed, you know, that might be a different story. But these are elevated lanes that are used at just a small fraction of their total capacity. So, you know, they block the views, they block a property development, they have cars basically fly by the development, you know, via an elevated lane, and all that combines to end up with a much less ambitious development, you know, on the banks of the St. John's River. And I think as a community, this, we shouldn't do anything less than transformative. We shouldn't do this halfway. If we're going to do it at all, we ought to do it to its full potential. And in this particular case, that would require those elevated lanes to come down.
All right. Rod on the north side. Rod, you're on with Mark Lamping.
Yes, good morning.
Yeah, go ahead, Rod.
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, my question is, when will we be able to see the new sign, the TIAA sign, go up on the stadium? Thank you.
Okay, that's right. It's going to be renamed TIAA Bank Field. When will we see that signage?
It looks like early June is when the official transition. And I do have to, you know, take a moment to really thank the leadership at EverBank, you know, going back to, you know, the previous CEO, Rob Clements, and the current Blake Wilson. You know, during that sale process, I know they took great care to make sure that the city of Jacksonville's interests were protected, you know, during the sale. And they've delivered on that 100%. You know, the TIAA Bank headquarters stay here in Jacksonville, all the jobs that represents, and the commitment that, you know, they have made in the past to this community and in the future, and, you know, highlighted by their announcement in terms of a huge commitment to habitat, to humanity. So we expect that transition on the name of the stadium to occur sometime in June.
Okay, there you go, Rod. Let's go to John up on Amelia Island. Hey, John, thanks for holding. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
All right, thanks. Go ahead.
Mark, the development sounds really great, and we're all big supporters of the Jaguars, but many of us are also supporters of WJCT, and is WJCT going to be able to coexist at its present location if that development goes forward?
Oh, thanks for that question. Yeah, of course, we are right across the street from the stadium. You know, Mark Lamping, in all the renderings we've looked at, our building is right there in the middle of everything. So that was kind of cool to see.
Well, you know, the best part about it, Melissa, and you guys have great offices there. And yes, our development plans do not encroach upon the, you know, the current WJCT studios. But, you know, think about it. Instead of you currently, you know, being surrounded by a, you know, a park that is mostly empty and a marina that is underused, you will be surrounded by a 24/7, 365 a day neighborhood. And, you know, that also has a lot of green space, but, you know, brings hotels and brings an active marina, brings residential, brings office space, brings restaurants, brings shops, brings entertainment. You know, I think it's going to make it a much more fun neighborhood. And those of us that, you know, have the opportunity to make our way to this neighborhood each and every day for work, like, you know, both Melissa and I do, I think it'll be a much more enjoyable place to come to work.
A lot more activity, yeah. And here is a quick email for you, Mark Lamping, from Bill. He is coming from Springfield. He lives in Springfield, and he writes, healthy, vibrant downtowns have the density that support businesses and events they host. In Jacksonville, we don't know what we want to focus on. One day it's the district, then the shipyards, and then Brooklyn. My worry is that we'll end up with billions spent and not enough to show for it, except a few isolated nodes of development that all struggle to survive long term. So that's something I know urban planners think about a lot, how to connect the nodes. So, you're building this exciting node of downtown development. What are your thoughts and what are your team's thoughts, Mark Lamping, about connecting it to the rest of the urban core, I guess, so that the whole downtown footprint is sort of all engaged together in this?
First, that's an exceptional point. I could not agree more with your emailer. That's one of the reasons that as Schott has looked at this, he wants to put together the right development team, deep-pocketed developers that can help deliver his vision, which is a lot of this project all coming out of the ground at the same time. We know that we have to achieve critical mass. This is not going to be done by simply doing one project and hoping that creates momentum for the next and then the next. Schott's vision is that a lot of these projects are happening at the exact same time. And in order to do that, you need to have committed partners that also are very strong financially and also have the staying power to make sure that, projects can see their way through from, early introduction, early development, which, sometimes means that they're not profitable all the way through to a very vibrant and sustainable development. That's Schott's vision. And it's been described to me by many developers as you have, this concept of a barbell. And at one end, we've got a lot of the exciting things that are happening in the Central Business District. And then if we can create a vibrant neighborhood here at the sports complex, what many believe will naturally happen from that is those two barbells will continue to connect as other developers come in and begin to realize the value that's been created by the developments at both ends, whether it's downtown Jacksonville or whether it's here at the sports complex.
Lots to talk about, and so sorry we couldn't get to every single call. Lots of interest in this, Mark. We didn't even get to the dog park, the Pet Paradise Dog Park. Want to make sure we get the name in. So much happening, and we so appreciate you sharing your thoughts with us about it. Lots of eager listeners wanting that update. So, Mark Lamping, Jaguars president, thanks for getting on the line this morning.
Thank you, Melissa. It's always my pleasure.
Great to talk to you. And much more still ahead on the show this morning. Later, a look at the 91-year-old legacy of the Florida Theater and the importance of historic preservation of those urban core gems. But up next, celebrity chef Matthew Madour talks to our own Lee Court in our Movable Feast. Keep listening.
Hi, I'm David Luckin, 89.9 station manager. I want to thank each and every one of you who called or went online to give during our Spring Pledge Drive last week. Thanks to you, we're able to continue bringing you programs like this. But if you haven't given, it's not too late. You can still make your pledge at wjct.org. And thank you again.
Join WJCT for Be My Neighbor Day, Saturday, May 5th, from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the WJCT studios. The day will include family-friendly activities, PBS Kids characters, food trucks, and so much more. The event is free, but reservations are required. For more information, log on to wjct.org/events.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday nights at 9 for Turntable Tuesday, only at the Electro Lounge on 89.9, your community, your world, your music.
Support for Movable Feast is made possible by 927 Events, event venue and catering.
Welcome back. Well, he's one of the most famous names in local dining with his flagship restaurant, Matthew's, 4 M Shack locations, the new Rue St. Marc, and more delicious ideas in the works. In today's Movable Feast, our look at culinary and hospitality trends around the area, Lee Court of the Women's Food Alliance speaks with renowned local chef Matthew Madure.
Have a banana, Hannah. Try the salami, Tommy. Give it to gravy, Davy. Everybody eats when they come to my...
You know, since the millennium, I see that there's been an explosion in the culinary appreciation in Jacksonville, not just the different types of restaurants and the chefs who have brought their dream to life, but you've really been a centrifugal force in this. From the time I met you at the Ritz-Carlton on Amelia Island, when you were the young executive chef, and branching out and bringing your first restaurant to life. Tell us a little bit about the journey.
The first article on me, didn't you, at the Ritz?
I think so. It might have been 1990.
Is that what it was?
Early 90s, when the Ritz first opened.
Early 90s, yeah. Yeah. Well, it's been a wild ride, to say the least. But certainly after leaving the Ritz and going into our own venture in San Marco in 96, you know, it's just exploded since then. You know, back then it was, there wasn't much around, really. Some good places, but nothing like it is now. And to be a part of, you know, the thriving scene that we're seeing now is just pretty amazing. And just watching the talent just, you know, grow over the years and kind of come through and develop. And it's neat to see that.
But you have a major role in that. Mm-hmm. Let's go back to 1996. You had a huge fan base in the Jacksonville area who would go up to Amelia Island. They seemed like a long trek at that time, but it wasn't. It was a 40-minute ride if you were in San Marco or Riverside or Ponte Vedra or wherever. People loved coming to the Ritz at that time, and they felt connected to you. Mm-hmm. So when you left the hotel and started your first restaurant, what happened?
Well, that's why I stayed in this area, is I felt such a connection and loyalty to the folks driving to the Ritz to enjoy our food and service. I felt, wow, for such a difficult business to thrive in, why not start with a good base of loyal friends and patrons who I knew would support us. So that was a lot to do with our decision to stay in Jacksonville.
And how long was it before you launched your second concept? Because you're a concept guy.
Yeah, I am a concept guy, which is, I'm not sure why I have 4 M Shacks, but I do love creating concepts and watching them grow and moving on to the next. But the first 3 years at Matthew's was, you know, very hard to get into. Booked up most nights. It was a very small restaurant. At that time, it was just 50 seats. And
but you made a big noise.
It was a big noise. Thank you. But anyway, we had some people just doing incredibly well. And one was my brother, David, and another one was Marshall Brown. And we were just outgrowing each other. So we decided to build another restaurant.
And what was the second one?
And they're both still there, believe it or not. It's 18 years later.
What was the second one?
Restaurant Madure.
You've accomplished a lot of different themed, and I hate to use the word themed, no, exquisite dining opportunities in North Florida. 5 years from now, will you have more, or will you just expand your geographic area and your outreach?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I have 6 children, which is just incredibly challenging and wonderful. So I don't know how much more I'm going to go, but we are opening up a place here end of the year. We took a lease.
Is it a secret?
No, it's not. I haven't talked about it in this capacity yet, but it's going to be on Gate Parkway, just south of JTB. And it's really going to round out our collection of dining establishments.
It's another M Hospitality.
It is.
It sure is. Does it have a name yet?
This will be breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Okay.
And it's going to be a cool little place. It's we're focusing on fresh milled flour.
Oh.
Yeah, so we're getting
bread?
Organic wheat berries in.
Bread?
We're going to have a milling room, and we're going to mill our flour. We're going to make fresh pizzas in the Politano style.
Wow.
Sandwiches. We're making all the fresh bread there. And we'll do sandwiches, salads, pizzas, and that kind of thing. And we'll have a full bar. And then for dinner, we'll probably notch it up some to more creative food and things like that.
Well, please don't share the name with us.
I won't.
I want to leave our listeners today with Chef Matthew Madure and what's going to happen at the end of this year with the mystery restaurant that's on Gate Parkway and focusing on milled wheat and deliciousness. So, Matthew Madure, I'm just thrilled to have you here. I hope you'll join me again soon.
Of course. We'd love to.
And I'm just delighted to see you. Thank you. I'm
awesome.
Honored.
Thank you, Lily.
Everybody eats when they come to my.
I can't wait to go there, too. Thanks, Lee. We'll be right back.
Community Hospice and Palliative Care. Since 1979, the compassionate guide for more than 200,000 patients facing advanced illness in Northeast Florida. Today, serving 16 counties, including yours. Available 24/7 to help you and your loved one. More at choosecommunityhospice.com.
Hello, I'm Doug Hansard, and I listen to the Florida Times Union On Demand as read by WJCT Radio Reading Service volunteers. The sound quality is excellent. This is a great asset for people like me, sightless and on the go. The Florida Times Union Daily on the radio reading website at wjct.org/radio reading. Take advantage of it, and while you're there, register as a listener.
If a hurricane threatens our state, Florida's public radio stations have joined forces to ensure you receive important storm information. No matter where you are, you can stay informed on the radio, online, on social media, and on the mobile app Florida Storms. Timely weather information is always available from WJCT. The Florida Public Radio Emergency Network is supported by Citizens Property Insurance. Online at citizensfla.com.
Welcome back. It's a vital part of the changing landscape of downtown Jacksonville. The Florida Theater, now 91 years old, is an architectural gem and a vibrant entertainment destination. It plays a key role in developing downtown, bringing people into the urban core, and keeping them there. Numis Aselin is CEO of Florida Theater, and he's here now with more about the economic impact of this institution. Good to see you. Good morning.
Good morning. Great to be here.
And let's start with the positive, the legacy of this beautiful, almost 100-year-old theater. You know, a lot of people don't realize there used to be a whole strip of theaters on Forsyth Street in the early part of the 20th century. You could go from theater to theater all night long. Now there's just this one beautiful place left, the Florida Theater.
So when the Florida Theater first opened its doors in 1927, there were 13 theaters in the downtown core.
13.
13. But there were five on a four-block stretch of Forsyth Street. So from Noonan to Hogan Street on Forsyth Street, there were already five theaters when the Florida Theater opened its doors. And the Florida Theater is the only one left. And I often think of what the area would be like if just one or two of those theaters had survived.
Yeah.
But we're still lucky to have the Florida Theater. And last year, 175,000 people came downtown for shows at the theater. Half of them came from outside of Duval County, which is great for our economy. And overall, the theater generated a $14 million impact for Jacksonville.
That's a big amount of money. That's sizable.
It's a big amount of money. That's every year. That includes $10 million of household income, over 400 jobs, and over $500,000 in state tax revenue and over $500,000 in city tax revenue. So, you know, in addition to making Jacksonville, you know, a more enjoyable and interesting place to live, there's a payback too.
Sure. And I don't know how you measure this particularly, but when there is an event happening at the Florida Theater at night, that also has a big impact in terms of increasing public safety in the downtown area. When the theater's lit up and all of the night spots around it have people milling around, it's my understanding that that makes it downtown a safer place. Not that it isn't safe already, but that there's a sort of a halo effect in terms of police feeling that things are calm and people are feeling comfortable walking the streets at night. That's a positive, too.
Yeah, the lights are on. There are people on the street. There are lots of people on the street. The downtown area is one of the safest places in the city in terms of crime. I'm sure that's been discussed many times here. I've been in a lot of the same meetings.
Yeah, downtown is not a dangerous place to go.
Yeah, and I understand why people might be intimidated if you've never gone there, but it's one of the safest places to go. And if you're going to a show at the Florida Theater, all you need to do is follow the crowd. I mean, pick a garage and follow the crowd. There have been several times recently that, 904 Music Hall is right, 1904 Music Hall is right around the corner from us, and Five and Dime Theater are now a block away. There's been a couple times recently when I was coming to work in the evening, and there's a line outside the Florida Theater, there's a line outside 1904, and there's a line outside Five and Dime. And suddenly it feels like an entertainment district that things are happening in.
That's right. And you want to preserve it. Let's talk about the state of the arts in Jacksonville. There has been a big cut in state funding for arts initiatives and arts institutions like yours.
Yes. So the state cut funding this year by over 60%. I mean, it was a huge cut from in the program we're funded in. Funding went from roughly $11.5 million to $2.5 million. So over 400 organizations statewide will split instead of $11.5 million, then I'll split $2.5 million, which is a devastating cut. For the Florida Theater, it was a very small piece of our budget. City and state funding combined represent less than 4% of our budget. So we'll survive. You know, one or two shows that might have otherwise happened might not now happen. But, you know, we'll be fine. But there are smaller organizations for whom that's a devastating cut. And it's painful to watch and painful to participate in.
Yeah, not good at all. It's good to know, though, that you're in good shape financially because you are such an important cultural institution. And as we continue to talk with Numa Cecil and president of the Florida Theater, we're going to take a quick break. But in a moment, we're going to tell you how you can be part of preserving Florida Theater and coming to, I think it's going to be one of the coolest events on the spring social calendar, Studio 54 Jax. If you never got to go to the real Studio 54, this is your chance to try to experience what that was like. We're going to take a quick break here and in a moment tell you all about it. So keep listening here on the show.
Community Hospice and Palliative Care. Since 1979, the compassionate guide for more than 200,000 patients facing advanced illness in Northeast Florida. Today, serving 16 counties, including yours. Available 24/7 to help you and your loved one. More at choosecommunityhospice.com.
This week, America's first national lynching museum and memorial opens in Montgomery, Alabama. 800 pillars represent counties where these brutal killings took place. Some counties are using this moment to revisit their past. Others are not. Could this museum pave the way for truth and reconciliation? Next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
on the next Fresh Air, David Kurtzer, who won a Pulitzer Prize for The Pope and Mussolini. His new book, The Pope Who Would Be King, is about Pope Pius IX, who became pope in 1846 and ruled over the Papal States. He instituted the doctrine of papal infallibility and saw progress and freedom of speech as anti-Catholic. His exile led to the emergence of modern Italy. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
President Trump wants to keep most transgender people out of the U.S. military. Nicholas Talbot wants to serve.
My purpose is to put on that uniform and do my job and serve my country. That's what it's all about. It's not about what you look like under that uniform.
As his legal challenge to the ban moves through the courts, he preps for boot camp. A transgender recruit this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Relax Radio, playing the soundtrack of your life nightly at midnight, only on 89.9 FM WJCT, your community, your world.
Welcome back. We're continuing our conversation right now with Florida Theater President Numa Seisalin, and we were talking about how important it is to preserve historic buildings like the theater. That's something that you're focused on as well, right?
Yes. Yes. A big part of what we do as a nonprofit, you know, our mission and our lease with the city, which owns the building, is that we maintain and preserve the building as a historic structure. So, you know, a lot of what we do is just making sure that the place doesn't get turned into a beer hall, say.
Sure. Yeah. And all of the great performances that you bring in pay for most of what you're doing, and then you fundraise for the remaining 15% or so.
Yes. So one of the reasons that the state funding cut doesn't kill us is, you know, it's just common business sense. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. Have a diversified portfolio. So we make money from ticket sales, bar sales, merchandise sales, T-shirt sales, ticket fees, theater rentals, and we fundraise, which covers 15% of our annual budget. And a piece of that is our annual fundraiser, which this year is May 19, titled Studio 54 Jacks. So we're transforming the inside of the theater into a disco for the night. We're extending the stage of the theater out into the auditorium so we can seat 200 people for a seated plated dinner.
On the stage.
On the stage. And then there'll be another 200.
Will there be a disco ball spinning right over their heads?
We already have it.
Oh, I love it.
So dinner. Live performances by guest artists performing the music of the era, Barry Manilow, Rod Stewart, Diana Ross, a live auction, of course. It is a fundraiser. Mm-hmm. And then 2 hours at the end of the evening of live disco dancing to the Boogie Freaks.
Yes.
Who are local and beloved. And it's going to be quite the evening.
Now, my only question is this, Numa. What are you wearing to Studio 54 Jacks? Because I'm assuming we need to go in costume, right?
So
70s style, so disco style.
Here's the way we're conceiving it, that it's not, and this is my out. This is my out from having to dress up.
No. You got to dress up. You're the guy.
Yes.
Your money, Numa, your money.
Well, I'm not.
You got to wear the John Travolta white polyester disco suit. That is my vision for you.
So that's my vision of Jake Gordon. Jake Gordon, and for those of you who don't know, is the president of Downtown Vision and has a costume suit for every occasion. We think of this as not a kitschy dress-up event, but like a glamorous evening.
Okay.
At the actual Studio 54. So if you were...
People dressed up.
And people dressed up in a big way. So we're thinking that this is, you know, if you were going to the actual Studio 54, you would dress to the nines. So, you know, we're expecting nightclub couture, glamour, glitz. And I will wear something.
You're going to... Oh, that does not give me anything to work with here. You got to be more specific.
So,
Inquiring minds want to know.
If I were going to wear anything, and if I were going to Studio 54, it would probably be a tuxedo. So,
oh, there you go.
Yeah.
But maybe more 70s style?
Yes.
Yes. Because that was a very specific look with tuxes back then.
Yes, it was. Fashion evolves.
thank God.
So,
but you know, now you've got me thinking. Like, if I go to this, what am I going to wear? Because think of the dresses women wore in that era.
Oh, yeah. I mean, think of Brooke Shields, yes. Liza Minnelli.
Bianca Jagger.
Yes.
That's who. When
Jerry Hall.
Jerry Hall. When you say Studio 54, those are the names that come to mind. Andy Warhol.
It was the hangout. Oh, speaking of Andy Warhol, so part of the evening, we're going to have a set of Andy Warhol photographic prints on display. So we're working the visual arts into this a little bit this year.
Wow. And so this is coming up, Florida Theater's annual benefit, May 19th, transforming the inside of this historic theater into the iconic Studio 54 for one night only. Studio 54 Jax, it's going to be called. If you've always wanted to see what it was like to live in that era, I should say, this is your chance. Although, you know, it'll be a little more PG rated than the real club was.
Yes.
Which is good.
And it benefits a nonprofit.
And it benefits the Great Florida Theater, which is also really good. So what else do people need to know to come get their ticket?
FloridaTheater.com under donate has the event page and all the information they need. And FloridaTheater.com also has tickets on sale for all of our upcoming shows.
Excellent. And, of course, this funds your historic preservation efforts, which is such a great cause because we do need to keep this cultural gem looking good for many decades to come. So go to FloridaTheater.com. Get your ticket now for Studio 54 Jax on May 19th. This is going to be a hot ticket, I think. Numa Saisalin, president of the Florida Theater. Now, picture it didn't happen with the tux. You've got to get lots of pictures posted. You know, we've got to see it. We've got to see everybody dressed up for this night. You can't just come in regular clothes.
We're an entertainment organization, so we're all about social media.
That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Murchard. Michelle Corum runs our board during the hour. And the show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Shevchuk. If you missed any part of today's show, just subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher or catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. 1A's up next with a look at the new memorial to the victims of lynching. It invites communities to deal with the legacy of racial violence. But will they? That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. 1A's up next, as I said, but if you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight, keep listening for music. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.